Today is February 4th, 2020. I am Leslie McCartney, and we're here with Katie Cullen and Roy Ashfelter at the National Park Service Bering Landbridge National Preserve offices in Nome, Alaska. And I want to thank you, Roy, so much for coming in today and speaking with you, and for Katie for hosting us. So if you just want to introduce yourselves too, just to be on the record, Katie?
Sure. I'm Katie Cullen. I'm the Interpretation and Education Program Manager here at Bering Landbridge National Preserve, and headquartered in Nome, Alaska.
I'm Roy Ashenfelter, born and raised in White Mountain. I live in Nome, been living in Nome since 82, married and two girls, and here to participate in this program.
And thank you so much, Roy, for coming in. We'll just start off with a little biographical information. You said you were born in the White Mountains. When was that?
I was born in 1955 in White Mountain. My parents are Alex and Annie Ashenfelter. I'm one of 10 children. I'm the baby of the group. In that village, there was maybe 150 people at the time, at the most. So I'm a real villager. And went to school at White Mountain, went to junior high and high school in Anchorage, went to UAF in Fairbanks, moved here to Nome in 82, been living here ever since. I work at Coeurac. I worked several places, but I've been working at Coeurac for over 20 years. And so, just enjoy living here.
So, just go back to UAF. What did you study at UAF, right?
At UAF, when I was going to school, I studied business administration. I just stuck with that. Got my AA degree. I didn't get my bachelor's, but got my AA degree. And then after that, I moved back to Anchorage. From Anchorage, moved up to here.
And so you said you've been at Coeurac for over 20 years. What do you do there?
My first role at Coeurac was doing helping with Native allotments. And those are individual Alaska Natives that fill out a form and receive a parcel of land when they qualify. And so Coeurac's role, it used to be BIA, but Coeurac's role was to take over the program and provide that service. And that service included sales, transactions, gift deeds, probates, a number of different things that individual landowners owned that Coeurac provided services for. And then lately, the last 7 years, I transitioned into a natural resource advocate. And what that mainly entails is dealing with subsistence issues, fisheries, game and fish, involved in shipping, involved in a lot of more land-based type things, or management of fishing game, trying to go into the North Pacific Fishing Management Council meetings to have them reduce their bycatch of salmon, go to Board of Fish meetings to participate in fisheries for chum, pink, and kings, and then also to the new one, which is the Federal Subsistence Board, which also provides the same type of issues for both fish and game.
So I just want to go back before we go forward. You had said you were a real villager when you were growing up.
Oh, yeah.
What do you mean? Explain what you mean by that.
Having been raised in a village, lived in Anchorage, lived in Fairbanks, lived in Nome, you grew up, you know, you just get these natural traits, I think, from a village life that, you know, that I think are unique to a village, like education, you know, just village education in itself is different. I think maybe our speaking skills aren't as good, and you know, just a way of life that I have learned since that time is really unique to the living skills that you grow up in a village versus an urban area. It's not bad or not good for either one, but I'm just saying that, you know, having been born a villager, that's what I learned without having to have a choice, really. You know, this is where you're born and raised, and so you grew up with that understanding. And
Describe some of the skills or understandings that you've just naturally grew up
with. So in the village in 55 through the 70s, it's not unique to any village in our region. There was no water and sewer, so you had to have an outhouse. You had to pack your own water. You had to chop your own wood. You had to walk to school every day. There was no such thing as storms to keep kids home. We just went to school every day. And then the other part about village life is, you know, you get to know everybody in the village. You have to go get your own food, whether it's berries, greens, fish, sea mammals, animals, trapping, you know. The lifestyle growing up in that. Those are the things you had to do and learn to understand and participate in, even at a young age. We had a dog team. My dad had a dog team, and every day we'd have to water and feed the dogs. You know, my dad did a little bit, but us kids, that was our job. Every day, go home and water and feed the dogs. So that was part of growing up, too. And then every morning, believe it or not, there's no electricity, no hot water. Every morning, someone would have to start the fire in the wood stove to warm up the house. So that was kind of, I forgot about that lifestyle a little bit, but it was fun. It's just what you, the environment you were in. You didn't know other people were living in nice warm houses 24/7. You know, growing up in the village, I got to experience that, and I, you know, really enjoyed those learning experiences and nuances that can't be or couldn't be taught anywhere else. Mm.
And the subsistence lifestyle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really enjoyed that. I carry the subsistence lifestyle activities today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what do you do today for subsistence? And
so I do just about everything I grew up doing. It depends on the season. Mm-hmm. I could start off with summer. Summer is salmon fishing time. When I was growing up, we used to cut the river that White Mountain's on is Fish River. That's the name of the river. It's the only inland village left in our region. It's 5 miles up the river, literally on a river. All the other villages have been vacated, like Council, Mary's Igloo. Those are true inland villages that once existed and had populations, but White Mountain's the only one maintaining a village on the in river
system. So what happened with the other villages?
Council, I think, just moved to Nome.
Okay.
And then Mary's Igloo got moved to Teller.
Is that because of erosion or there's problems with the river?
You'd have to ask them, but okay. My understanding, education and hard to get to that village, that was some of the reasons. And that may have been the same way with the King Islanders moving off the island, but you have to ask them. I'm pretty sure there was pressure for that reason for both villages to move because of their difficulty in access.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, ask those people that question and they'll verify more clearly what happened.
So summer, you had the river right there so you could fish.
Oh, yeah. And so that lifestyle, being born and raised in a river, I think Koyuk and a few other villages may do what we do, maybe Unalaklik too. And some in Teller, maybe Mary's Igloo. And what we do different in those villages, especially in White Mountain, is we get our fish from the river, which is different than the ocean. It's the same fish, but it's different. Different in that it's lost its fat content.
Hmm.
And so the fish that we cut and hang, in our opinion, dry and preserve better throughout the winter than fish that are cut and hung on the ocean. The fat content is the difference, or lack of fat content in our river. So when I was a kid, we hung about 2,000 to 3,000 salmon, both pink and chum, and that was mainly to feed ourselves and the dog team. There was no dog food back then. You had to make it, create it, get it to feed your dogs. So the abundance of salmon in the river was that link to making sure you had a good food source for your dogs throughout the winter.
And each family would harvest that much too, right?
Several families would. Mm-hmm. Not all of them. It's just that, you know, some families made a real concerted effort and understood the effort behind trying to put food away, dog food away, and people food away for consumption. So that's summer, and that was...
Berries, too? Do you pick berries?
End of July, uh-huh. Early August is berry time. So that's salmon berries, blueberries. Mainly salmon berries and blueberries would come a little bit later. Cranberries and blackberries just a little bit later in August. But salmon berries we would pick first because they're available first in toward the end of July. So that was part of camping, July and August. And then in August you would switch to hunting birds. We would switch to hunting birds and seals, marine mammals, moose hunting would start maybe beginning of September, but mainly in August it was trying to get birds. There was some late fall run of silvers, so that type of activity. And still trying to gather. Oh, the other thing I remember too, we used to have mucklucks. And because you had dogs, what I remember in the fall time was cutting grass. Lots of grass. And we would store it in the shed. And the purpose behind the grass was to put inside our mucklucks. And then the other main purpose was to put bedding for the dogs inside the dog houses. So that was the reason for collecting grass.
How many dogs would you have?
My dad kept a string of about 60, between 16 and 20. Wow. Literally. He didn't try to have more than that, when I remember. And if he did, if a dog had puppies, he would just call them out. That was just the way it was. You couldn't afford to maintain a large dog kennel. So he kept that size dog team for what he knew to keep. So that was it. That was maybe 16 to 20 dogs at the most.
And the purpose of the dog team was for trapping?
Food, gathering wood, food, and hunting in the wintertime. And so our winter times, so still today, it's quite long.
Mm-hmm.
So you're able to do quite a bit. And that was the only way to get around if you wanted to get around in a timely way.
Right.
Other people walked. But if you had a dog team, you can do a lot. So that was the reason why we cut grass, I remember right. And then being born in White Mountain, believe it or not, we had trees. And there's still trees over there. And I didn't know that other villages living on the coast didn't have access to the trees that we had every day. You just had to go out in the trees and find a dead tree hanging up and then cut it down and bring it home, cut it up and burn it. So that was a different lifestyle from other villages in our region. Maybe back to the villages that did have trees around them is White Mountain, Koyuk, and I think Unaklete are the only tree villages with access to trees within a reasonable distance. Shaktuluk, I think, too, but and Ilam, don't miss out Ilam there. But anyway, so that being around trees was a what I thought was a great thing because you had access to firewood. And so in late fall, my dad would take us boys up to the river and we'd go cut trees for the winter. We'd haul them down to the cut a whole bunch of trees, and we had a long skinny boat. It was a river boat, and it was only maybe 3 feet wide at the bottom, mm-hmm. and maybe a 2 foot high on the sides, but it was like 16 or 18 feet long, wow. and it had a square front and a square back. And by the time I grew up, we had an outboard motor. My brothers and sisters that were older than me used dogs to move the boat up the river. So that was, by the time I grew up, there was a small outboard on the back of our boat.
And they were flat-bottom boats?
The flat-bottom boats. And every shallow, you pull the boat over the shallow, being born and raised on a river, and that was just the way it was. It was just, you just get out and pull the boat over the shallow. And then you push it into the deeper water and motor up the river some more. That was the way we traveled. Now it's just jet boat, mm-hmm. and you don't have to worry about any of that. So that was maybe the biggest thing in the fall was trying to get as many ducks and geese and cranes and swans as possible. Trying to get food like seals, and then gathering wood. And then early winter is kind of like waiting for the winter to happen. You still got out and did things, but I remember ice fishing through the ice when it's not too thick and but safe to be on. We'd ice fish for whitefish, for grayling, for trout. We used to get those by the sackfuls. The other thing, back to a little bit in late fall, is there was a fall run of what we call skipjack. Mm-hmm. I forgot the native word for the skipjack, but used to seine for them late in the fall, and we used to fill those. We used to have gunny sacks, mm-hmm. and we used to fill the gunny sacks up with skipjacks, and try to get as many fish as we can through the ice. We had no freezers, so we had a shed on the back of our house. We had a regular pitched house, log cabin house, and on the front of it was a shed. And the shed was only maybe 8 feet high and had a slight slope to it. We put all our food up there.
And it would just naturally freeze.
It would just naturally freeze and thaw up there on the roof. And would be out of reach from any loose dogs, anything else. And that was actually kind of fun, because I still try to do it today. Mm-hmm. As your fish freeze and thaw, it gets tainted. It has because of the freezing and thawing, it has the taste change. The best way to describe it has a natural ferment, mm-hmm. but
It's not rotten.
It's not rotten. You just knew. That's just the way it was. You know, you just went up to the roof and ate your. They would send me up to the roof, or one of us boys up there, and there was gunny sacks, and we'd have to empty the gunny sack out and chop off some pieces because he'd be frozen solid, and then bring them in the house, and then if you can get them whole. And or get a piece big enough so when it was brought in the house, it would thaw out, and then you'd have most of your whole fish that way to cook. But at the end of the day, what I remember right, I tried to do it again, is I was trying to remember what I was missing. I wanted that tainted fish taste again, and I've been trying to do that and try to, you know, maintain that effort. Mm-hmm. And then as winter come on, you know, it was education. It was back then for me, it was, you started school in September. I'd run home. Believe it or not, my parents provided three meals a day, which is which I thought everybody did in the village, but found out later that wasn't true. And then you just did your thing in the village, growing up, visiting your friends. Yeah, it was a real wonderful lifestyle. Wintertime was, my dad would go out and go hunting, trapping.
He still ran a trap line in the 60s then, did he?
Yeah. He wasn't like a prolific trapper. There was some village men in our village that really made a super duper effort at catching lots of land animals, lots of fur animals. My dad was a minimal trapper. He didn't spend a lot of time trapping. But other men did. There was not a lot, but there were several men that really made a concerted effort to get furs for sale. Wintertime is just, you know, doing the winter stuff. And then as springtime rolled around, marine mammal birds come back, wild birds come back. So it was, you know, you start the cycle again. The biggest thing was hunting as much wild birds as that was coming in and then gathering their eggs. We used to get seagull eggs, all the eggs we could think of, except for certain birds, but just about every wild bird, including seagulls, we'd go out and go collect their eggs. The other place we gathered eggs was from mer eggs. We call them utpa, and that's the cliffs off a bluff. We used to walk over there, and you can get as many eggs as you can. You can get thousands of eggs. And the way we preserved them was we had a cellar across the river, and back then it was permafrost and underneath, and so all the wild birds that we put down in there. Anything we needed to keep frozen, we'd put down in that cellar. Eggs, everything, you know, everything, whatever we can do to preserve food. That was where we kept our frozen. Tried to keep frozen stuff. And then as time went on, motors and everything got advanced. Electricity came to the village. Airport was there. We only had, back in the day when I remember, a plane would come once a week. The whole village would run down to the, because the airplane, they would land on the ice in the winter. They couldn't land on the airport in the winter because the airport, there was no maintenance for the airport. Mm-hmm. So summertime the airport would work, and in wintertime they would only land on the ice in front of the village. But it was a big event. I still remember many, many, many times running down and meeting the plane, or even in the summertime running up the hill just to go see what kind of plane came in and, you know, visit. And then springtime, the barge would come up the river to fill our store up with groceries, and the people, the men and a few women would unload the barge. It was all hand unload, and then fill the store up with, you know, whatever the store had ordered for us to have or buy during the winter. Lots of canned foods, of course, sugar, milk, those kinds of things. So, anyway, that's where I grew up.
Oh, sounds idyllic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it must have been a big change to go to Anchorage to go to school.
So it was not unique. All the schools in the villages went up to eighth grade. Mm-hmm. So junior high and high school was outside of every village in all of Western Alaska. We were traveling to different places. And I ended up in Anchorage because that's where my other brothers went. So, and just followed them. If they would have went to Mount Edgecombe like my older brothers and sisters, I would have gone there too. But it was just, they came back and said, hey, Dad, Mom, going to school in Anchorage is real good. Well, they had no experience of going to Mount Edgecombe. Like, they went to three different places, like you would go choose a college for your education, you know. nowadays you do that, but back then you just went wherever the school system sent you.
Right.
So, but anyway, they came back. My older brothers and sisters came back and said, Anchorage is good. So that's where I went. So.
Great.
But it was that way for all the kids.
Yeah.
There was choices for several of us. It was Anchorage at the time. In Anchorage, we stayed at in people's homes called a boarding home program. In Mount Edgecombe, it was a boarding school, mm-hmm. and several other ones in Lower 48, right. like Chamawa, Chilaco, and a few other Native American boarding schools that was for them, but also included educating Alaskan kids.
Right. Oh, interesting childhood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So what we're talking about in these interviews is biographical information like what you've just provided, Roy, but then we're going to kind of switch to changes that perhaps you've noticed over your lifetime in different areas, especially with the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve area or areas in around there. Can you talk about things that you've seen that are perhaps different from your childhood to today?
So first of all, I go to the Bering Land Bridge every year.
Do you?
Yes, every March or April, we go up to the Serpentine Hot Springs every year. The lady we brought from the National Park Service was Leah Knights. Mm-hmm. She mm-hmm. went with us. We took her up there. So I have a lot of personal experience and really enjoy going to the springs there.
And how do you get up there, Roy?
Snowmobile.
Huh.
Snowmobile up there.
How long of a trip is that?
It's about 120 miles one way. It takes about six hours.
Hmm.
So, sometimes we're breaking trail. And then we have a cabin, too, at Pilgrim River Bridge that we stop there. And we always turn on the oil stove and keep it on. Hmm. So when we come back, it's warm. Mm-hmm. It's like a little refrigerator when you first open the door. And it takes about 6 to 8 hours for the oil stove to heat up the place to make it livable. But at the end of the day, once you get the oil stove in there going for more than 6 hours, the temperature is back to normal living conditions and stuff. So it's not anyway, so we leave it on real low, so when we come back through it's sometimes even up to 80 degrees inside the cabin. So that's my little thing.
So you've been going up there every year since when?
About the last 10 to 12 years.
Okay.
So as far as subsistence activities and the changes, I think the biggest change is sea ice.
Mm.
That's the biggest change.
How has it changed?
Less sea ice. And it goes out earlier. So as a sea mammal hunter, which I do every year and been doing since I was a little boy, you go out on the ice when it first starts to break off from shore.
And when would that
be? That would normally be like toward the end of April through May.
Okay.
And then lately we've been going beginning of April. Lately meaning the last 3-4 years. And so by trying to go out there during the ice breaking events, there's lots of pan ice out in the ocean right, near Nome here, and lots of seals. That's mainly what we hunt here, both ringed and bearded seals. We try to get those, and what they do is they like to rest on the ice and use the ice to forage off, or excuse me, rest and then go in the water to forage or do whatever they do as seals. So access to them during that time of the year is preferred, because if you get one and you just tow it back up on the ice and then you butcher it there and bring it home. So that was hunting on pan ice provides that opportunity. If it's open ocean, you could still do it, but you got to take your game long ways to take care of it. So we've time it so that when the ice breaks off, we're out there.
So you're saying that the ice is breaking off earlier?
Yeah.
So instead of going up in your usual time, you'd have to accelerate that and go a couple weeks earlier
then. Yeah.
And are you finding that the ice is the same thickness or thinner or different?
No, it's maybe less abundant,
mm-hmm.
but the thickness is there.
Okay.
I'll put it this way, safe enough to get on to butcher. That's what we're looking for.
Right.
And then the other thing is, freeze up is a lot later too. That's real obvious. So those are the wintering conditions.
So a lot later, like a couple weeks, a month?
Like a month.
Wow.
We had people boating in January, 2 years ago, which is crazy. But you could still boat in November, late November, early December. And that has changed to that event. And you just, with those conditions, you just have to be more careful.
I heard on the radio this morning they were talking about seals losing a lot of weight and not being as healthy. Have you heard of that?
Not yet.
Okay.
There was an unusual, unusual.
They said they didn't have as much fat on them. Yes, they were called something unusual, and they sink.
There was a unusual something event.
Mm-hmm. It was an unusual mortality.
Mortality event, yes.
Yeah, quite a few years ago, maybe 6-8 years ago.
Okay.
What that entailed for the sea mammals that we're hunting, mainly the seals, they had lesions on, red lesions, or their hair loss. You know, we were sending those in whenever we could for necropsy and those kinds of things to help figure out what's causing that. There hadn't been any solutions yet for that. But back to whether or not seals are skinny or whatever, I haven't witnessed that yet.
Okay.
That doesn't mean there are not a few that you ran into that aren't healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be because they got hunted by another sea mammal, like killer whale or those kind of things. So, but as far as healthy, I haven't experienced blubber thickness being not thick enough and or not having healthy food to eat.
Mm.
So for me, it hadn't changed yet to the point where that's the norm,
mm-hmm.
and people are experiencing that. I personally haven't done that.
So for you, it's just basically the seasons are being accelerated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both on both ends.
Yeah.
Winter seasons is shorter. Winter seasons is taking longer to occur and happening earlier. The snow events, believe it or not, when I was a kid, we used to have snowstorms all the time. We used to make these giant snow caves, and yeah, so the last few years when we've gotten lots of snow, I just thought that was normal. You know, maybe climate change. For a few years, there was a lot less snow.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember coming to Nome, and there were snow drifts on houses, all the way around our houses. People didn't have to tunnel their way in and out. And that was a normal thing, these snowstorms. And to me, it's exciting to see them back again in that way. There was a period of time, maybe in the late 70s, early 80s, when they weren't as severe. Maybe we had some real bad ones in there, but as far as consistency throughout the winter, to me, it's somewhat back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
But every year's different, right? The last 2 years, we had tons of snow. This year, there's hardly any snow. So anyway,
mm-hmm.
go figure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this year, what's the ice like? Is it?
Oh, very good question. It's busted up.
Mm-hmm.
It's froze really bad, what we call really bad. In real cold winters, normal winters, we call it that, you'd have some places where there'd be long pieces of frozen flat ice. And what that comes from is when the When the temperature drops cold really fast, the surface of the ice freezes, and it freezes thick enough to where as the winter freeze continues, because it's thick enough, it's able to maintain its place despite the changes that are occurring that are natural, like EBOOs and stuff that occur when the ice breaks off out in the ocean, and the current change, wind change, they just force the ice up into the shore. This year and the last year, the freezing was not as intense. So you have lots of pockets of little pieces of chunks of ice here and there. And it's what we call busted up ice that froze, at least in front of Nome. I haven't been down the coast yet to see what that looks like. But just between the stretch between 13 miles out of Nome, you both west and east, and then just a little bit offshore, it's busted up ice. Right. So.
Yeah, because when I flew in, it looked really busted up.
Yeah.
And the actual Bering Sea, I call it flat pancake kind of ice, it looked, there was a lot of that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't look like it's really frozen very far out.
No. The other thing is that the distance, too, is shorter as far as... the cold weather. Mm-hmm. The cold weather we had in January made the sea ice back to a little bit more normal, in my opinion, meaning freezing farther offshore.
Right.
It's still... Back in the normal days, we used to have shore ice even up to a mile offshore that you can access before you get in the water if you wanted to do something in the winter. But now, I think it's just a quarter mile, maybe half a mile, depends. So it's a little bit shorter, but still, with the cold weather we had in January, the shore ice was created.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means for those that want to ice fish for crab, they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. So do you normally go up to the preserve then, mostly in the winter time then, Roy? Because you said you end up surfing the hot springs.
So you can't hunt in the preserve when there's no snow. Okay. Well, you can, but you got to walk. Who the heck's going to walk? So I hunt on the edge of the preserve for moose and caribou. There's lots of trails. Mainly from previous mining activity in that area. And they're still mining pockets, if you will. And the way those guys got in, or ladies, whomever was out there mining, created lots of trails. Not that you can't create a new one, but it just provides access to that. To the edge of the Bering Lands Preserve that you can parallel the line, if you will, and hunt there. But so my main access to the preserve is wintertime.
Mm-hmm. Any changes that you've noticed in the moose or the animals that you hunt for subsistence?
No, not yet. Okay. There's still thousands of caribou. I was around the Serpentine Hot Springs. There's a few moose, but as far as abundance, it just depends on the migration of the caribou, and that's unpredictable. You can't say that climate change affected them and or the preserve in that way, at least animal-wise, maybe later on, but right now, today, it just depends on when the caribou come in.
Mm-hmm. And which caribou herd is it?
It's the Western Arctic caribou herd. There is a year-round abundance of caribou in that area.
Oh, so they don't migrate?
Not all of them.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, no, we've been hunting caribou there for the last 20 years.
Hmm.
Not in the preserve, but the caribou that are in the mountains, they prefer to be in the mountains in the summer and fall time. And their survivability is run.
Hmm.
So they like to see what's coming toward them, and then they run. Mooses hide, caribou is stand still, muskoxes stand still, You know, each one has its own way of surviving. And muskrats got short legs and can't run anything, so their instinct is to stand in a circle or form a circle, and then they get nervous and try to run away. And then you can, so there, anyway, so each animal has its own way of trying to survive, and caribou's is running.
Right. When you've been out at Serpentine in the winter, do you sometimes see like thousands of caribou right in that area?
Every year.
Wow.
Every year, it's depending on abundance.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen maybe 10,000. And I've seen maybe 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it just depends on the migration
mm-hmm.
into that area. But what Serpentine Hot Springs area provides is an invaluable food source, because it's really rocky, and the snow's not that thick on the mountaintops. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so eating for them, foraging for them is much easier up in the mountains.
And I'm wondering, with the hot springs, we get a little bit temperature change, more lichens grow?
Maybe on a drainage system,
mm-hmm.
maybe. I'm not a lichen knowledgeable person, except that the mountaintop, I don't see them feeding so much in the drainage
oh.
area. I see them mainly feeding up high, hanging out up high. So the mountaintops around Serpentine Hot Springs is a food source for caribou.
Hmm.
So.
I've been out in the summertime, and you'll see certain areas
yeah.
along that mountain where you can see evidence of where the caribou have been kind of digging for lichen and,
right.
and you know, different patterns in that lichen from what caribou have been their activity, which is kind of neat to see the way that, yeah, that lichen grows in that area.
Yeah, amazing. Huh. So have you noticed any vegetation changes around the area then at all, Roy, or?
I think the biggest one is abundance of willow growth.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that's a natural thing, because I grew up in a village, and you go back home and the trees are taller. But I think the way I understand it, the willow growth is expanding in the world because of climate change, and the willows also provide a food resource for moose.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So the biggest change, I think, is just growth of willows. I think that's the biggest change I see.
Are the willows growing further?
They're expanding. So
out.
They're both growing taller and expanding out.
Right.
Yeah. So that's, I don't know. Seems to me that's been happening since millennia, right? So
mm-hmm.
thousands of years, whatever that, however you say that correctly. But with the climate change and warmer temperatures, it's just they're able to grow faster and longer and maintain their growth, and then absorb the cold winter better, and then be ready to go again soon as spring thaw happens.
So. And I always think of them as a great food source, you know. So if you've got the willows and the moose follow, and then you have the rabbits, and then you have the prey on the rabbits.
Yeah. So anyway, when I was growing up, that was the other thing I grew up with. Did all the time was hunt rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
I used to trap rabbits, hunt rabbits.
Snares?
I wasn't a good snarer.
Okay.
I did mostly traps.
Because
mm-hmm. I learned that. I didn't do the snare that much, but I did do the trapping. I got really good at it. And then hunting too, hunting for rabbits. Even as a little boy, that was the other thing, that you can't, I guess the rules are now different because of dangers that humans provide to each other. But at the end of the day, when I was growing up as a boy, as soon as you could lift a gun and shoot, that's what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was just the way it was. It wasn't, there was the idea behind safety and those kinds of things, which is a good focus today. you just had to learn how to hunt because that's the way you got your food. And so I remember as soon as I can get a gun up to my shoulder, my grandma had a real small 22, a real small one. So I got to learn how to use that one. You know, I'm not a big guy to begin with, but growing up with a small rifle, I was able to use that one. Mm. Learn how to shoot with that one. So anyway, I didn't know it at the time, but that's just the way it was. Yeah.
Mm. Have you noticed differences in beaver populations or expansion over time?
Absolutely.
Just thinking of different animals.
Yeah, when I was growing up, there's no beavers, literally, in our drainage system. I remember when I was a little boy, someone shot a beaver, and we thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Now they're so prolific that they're bad. I joke. the beavers have moved in, and they're everywhere. That's the real big thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's just a natural progression in life for the, you know, because the area that they live in have grown in our region provides a resource for them that, mm-hmm. that as those move in, it's so unique and special and no danger to them other than humans and maybe being eaten by other things. But as far as one animal that has really proliferated in our region, it's beavers.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder with the willows moving further, because is willow one of their food sources?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so yep. They're going to follow their food source.
Yeah, you know, you watch them in the fall time, they're really busy as a beaver. They're cutting willows, and they cut the willows upstream from their home. Hmm. They float them down, and then as soon as they get to their house, they dive with the willow underneath the water and stick it in the bottom of the river.
Wow.
You know, they figured out how to do that. It's always interesting. Some beavers make beaver castles, and some beavers make beaver houses. The beaver castles are the ones that are really big, and it's kind of neat to see. And then there's regular beaver houses. So I was wondering if those guys that make the castles are kings and queens, and they just live there longer and have more access to a better resource and are able to make a better home, hence the reason beaver castle. And then there's the ones that make houses on the river, mm-hmm. riverbanks, and some of them aren't very bright because they make a river house on the riverbank where the ice busts up their house. And then others have figured out on the leeward side of the river they put their house on, and it doesn't, when the river ice goes out, it doesn't affect their house. Mm-hmm. I don't think they plan it that way, but anyway, you just see all that activity. But the beavers have really proliferated our region.
Have muskrat come in then too at all, buddy?
When I was a kid, they've always been here.
Okay.
Yeah, they've always been. We've always had muskrat. Yeah.
But beaver wasn't.
Beaver wasn't there.
So are people hunting beaver at all then today, or?
Believe it or not, you know, when I look at us compared to the interior, mm-hmm. where the beavers have been there, umpteen years.
Food source there.
Yeah, it's a good food source for them, and it's maybe a hide for us.
Right.
It's not a real food source for us.
Yeah.
So when I get a beaver, if I get one, and I bring it to my buddy, and he skins it, and gets the hide tanned and stuff, but I'm not much of a beaver hunter person.
Yeah.
I take my friends out to do it in the springtime, because their hides are really good in the spring. And if you wait just a few weeks into spring thaw, they end up not having good hides, just like squirrels and stuff. They end up fighting, you know, biting each other, making holes in their hides, and so they're not healthy as far as a hide source.
Right.
The other thing I forgot to mention was squirrel. We used to call it squirreling.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Growing up in the village of White Mountain and in the mountains and stuff, we used to have, there used to be spring migrations of people and fall migrations of people going out and trapping and getting squirrels. My folks used to get them by the hundreds. And it was not only a good food source, but also the hide on a squirrel, because it's real soft and supple and really, really light. But believe it or not, we had squirrel skin parkas, we had squirrel skin pants, we had squirrel skin gloves. The suppleness, the lightness of it, the warmth it provided for us, in comparison to other warm hides, the biggest comparison is the lightness of a squirrel parka and still having that warmth. Mm-hmm. That's the difference.
Even compared to caribou.
Hides, we had the caribou hides, we mainly use them for sleeping on. Mm-hmm. And the thickness of the hide made it a little bit, the hair wouldn't stay too good.
Right.
Compared to it. And the squirrel hide fur stayed on. You'd literally have to grab and get tweezers to pull off the hair, even after a while.
And what about rabbit skin?
Rabbit skin, there was too
rough.
It was too thin. You could do things with it, but it wasn't for like a garment or anything. You can do rabbit skin mitts, you can do rabbit skin things, but rabbit hide would tear real easy, so you had to make different choices with that.
So it must have taken quite a few squirrels to make a parka.
Oh yeah, I think, believe it or not, my mother-in-law was the last squirreler in the whole region. She maintained that lifestyle, even in the 2000s, till she passed away. Not kidding, she was literally the last person that I know of that made an effort to trap squirrels in the fall.
Yeah.
So
it's not so much done anymore?
Not that I know of.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. Yep, so.
Just getting back to the beaver, you were saying that there's so many beaver, and of course they dam things up and they recreate the landscape. Has that happened in the area, or is it mostly on the rivers? Because if they start damming up and create lakes and the lakes drain.
So the answer is yes, and it doesn't matter where they are. I've seen them in the Imrik Basin, mm-hmm. which is a salinity, salt water, fresh water mix. They hang out there. As long as there's willows and food and things to do whatever, they mainly hang out in the fresh water, but at the end of the day, I see them hanging out where there's salinity level, not total salt water, but there's a salinity level of in that water that you don't want to get a bucket over and try to boil it and cook with it, because it's going to, it's not going to taste good. So I seen them there, but yeah, they dam up rivers, really, streams is what they mainly hang out on, make a change to. So, the beavers are wherever they can make a home and find a tributary that they can hang out in that won't be affected by the spring runoff. Plus, when they make their dams, too, they create that barrier. Mm-hmm. So when the spring runoff happens, it doesn't happen. It has to go over the dam. Mm-hmm. It's not as like a flow.
Right.
Normal flow would be. But, yeah.
And then do you fish still?
Absolutely.
So have you noticed any changes in the fishing? You talked about seals, but...
Abundance of salmon is the same. Hmm. Depends on where you were. We had a chum crasher in the Nome region and in Ilam region back in the early days, and that was, in our opinion, due to the high seas fishery.
And when would that have been?
In the 80s.
Oh.
So
the fisheries were harvesting too much to let the chum
come up? Yeah, absolutely. So the North Pacific fishery fleet mainly goes after pollock. The the Alaska fishery area and fishery mainly goes after red salmon. That's their money. That's their money fish. They bycatch chum, or mainly chum in their fisheries, both fisheries, in depending on the abundance of chum that they catch. We think they affected the runs into our rivers. Mm-hmm. So we attended many meetings trying to ask them to reduce the bycatch and or interception of chum.
And how has that
We worked? Made some inroads, okay. Baby inroads.
First what do they do with the chum when they catch it?
The pollock fishery dumps them overboard. They have a justification for that. And then I think the area and fishery, which is along the Aleutians, I think they have to retain those salmon.
And they process them for something?
The answer is you have to ask them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or maybe even the local fishing game guy will tell you what they do with them.
Yeah.
Or what do they end up doing with them?
Right.
They have to count them though.
So is the chum numbers returned for you?
Absolutely. So the salmon is returned in all our streams except for Solomon. But I don't fish down there for salmon. So the other thing so I go to my mom's. We'll call my mom's place Michuk. That's the name of our camp, mm-hmm. where we cut and hang fish there. And then we go hang on that Pilgrim River Bridge for reds. Abundance of reds has, I guess, increased lots. And that's due to fertilizing Salmon Lake. It's due to man-made efforts.
Oh.
To create a greater abundance of red salmon. So that's happened within the last 15 years or so.
So how have they done that? Can you explain
So they to studied me? The red salmon source there, tried to figure out why is it that this lake maintains this number of reds? And is it due to no food? Is it due to poor runoff, you know, so they studied the river and did this and that. At the end of the day, I believe fish biologist people figured out that the Salmon Lake didn't have enough nutrients in it for the baby fry.
Right.
So that was the reason why they figured that there wasn't enough red salmon. So they added a food nutrient every summer and spring, mm-hmm. and voila.
It's gone up.
Huh. Yeah. So, anyway, red salmon are excellent for smoking.
Mm-hmm.
They stay better. They preserve better when you make a fillet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's due to their fat content and their quality of fish flesh. It's a little bit different than chum and pink. It's not that you can't freeze them. Some reason reds preserve better.
Right. Well, that's good news.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Yep. So.
So, any other observations of anything else that sort of changed in the fishery, then, Roy?
Not that I know of. We still get whitefish, grayling,
trout.
No, I don't. See much change there. There, you know, every year is different, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, springtime fishing for trout, just it's the normal thing, I think, where sometimes it's more prolific than others.
Yeah,
abundance is greater days than others. Whitefish, grayling fishing, pike fishing is normal.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah.
Interesting. Can you think of anything else, Katie?
I was wondering, when you were growing up in White Mountain, and you were sharing a little bit about the different seasons, did you as a kid have a favorite? Like, what was your favorite season as a kid?
I think springtime is my favorite. I hated picking berries. Not to sound racist or biased or anything, but that's a woman's job. At least I thought so.
You said you
But I love eating berries, so
You were said you were one of 10 children and you were the youngest. How many brothers and sisters?
There were six of us boys, and my mom and dad had three biological ladies, and then they adopted my sister.
Okay. So I was just wondering if
my sister was from my oldest sister. And that was just a natural thing, you know. You just took in. It was not. We were no unique or anything like that. My oldest sister at the time, I don't know any of the circumstances. All I know is my dad came to Nome, picked her up, brought her home, and she's 6 months older than me. Mm-hmm. So that was just the way it was.
Right. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if it was all boys, if that's why you had to pick berries, because there was no girls.
No, you know, preserving food, collecting food was a real serious thing. And, you know, being kids, you know, we were told you had to go pick berries. There was no ifs, ands, or buts. You had to do it. I didn't like it, but I wasn't the greatest berry picker either. At least I didn't concentrate that hard. At least I didn't think so. Plus, my brothers and sisters thinks I got away with everything. I don't think that's true. Didn't get spanked very often or whatever. Yeah.
All those experiences, Ryan, growing up that way, how does that affect the way you work at Quirk today?
Believe it or not, my mom was a happy person. I don't speak my language. Mm-hmm. We didn't speak our language in our home. My mom and dad, I listened to them, and my older brothers and sisters, you know, they all conversed in our native language. But it was just a natural thing. Natural is not the right word. Maybe just observation kind of thing. They weren't teaching you, but they were speaking it themselves, and it wasn't like I was the only family in the village my age not learning our language. That was just a normal thing. I didn't know till later why that happened. But that being said, I grew up, my mom was a happy person. So hard work, just being, you know, I think just the human thing, you know, there's human people. We all know this. There's people out there that no matter what race or whatever, have issues in their life. Not that none of us don't, but some people just have made it harder for themselves to be here with us. But my mom was a good person. She was really happy, and so I got to see that as part of how I grew up. Hard work every day. She would, you know, I guess maybe feeding boys is much harder than feeding girls. And that we eat lots. So she would make, when I was growing up, she would make 7 loaves of bread. And they were gone by the week. Every week she'd be making breads, baking bread, making rolls, every day cooking dinner. So I just got to see that part of it. And my dad was a hunter and a fisher, a very good one. I'm not bragging or anything, but he made a real concerted effort to put food on the table. He was very good at it. He really made an effort that we went up the river and cut and hang fish. When you asked earlier about lots of families doing it, not every family did it, but we did it, and that was making sure that we had food for our dogs, and that takes effort. You know, that takes consistency, you might not like doing it, you might not like cutting 500 fish a day, but you're going to do it. And that's, you know, that's the household I grew up in. So what it did for me now is that I think I have a good attitude. I think I work hard at Quirk. I think I contribute, and I still enjoy life. So,
wonderful.
Voila. Yeah. It's not that.
So after everybody grew up and kids left home, what happened with your mom and dad? Did they stay there?
Yeah. They both lived and passed away in White Mountain. My mom lived to be 96.
Wow.
What was really special about her is that she had her physical abilities till she passed away. No cane, nothing.
Eyes were good. Good.
Well, no, she had macular.
Oh, degenerative.
Degenerative. Her hearing wasn't that good, but all the aging factors for an elder person that I see, that I've witnessed in life, she had her physical abilities with her right till she passed away, and that to me is good, because I remember going over for her funeral and stuff, and the health aides, you know, that take care of our village people, mm-hmm. said your mom's medical records are just thin, meaning mm-hmm. meaning she was just a healthy person, and rarely ever went up to the clinic, maybe, you know, for flu shots or whatever, the normal things that people go through that mm-hmm. Need health assistance for. She didn't need a lot for her. Wow. Yeah, so my dad was a different way. He binge drank, and so that was where I experienced mm-hmm. that. But other than that, he was real focused on making sure we had food on the table.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about today that you want to share with us?
Maybe the difference between moving around today and back when I was growing up. I got all the toys, and I think when you die with all your toys, you did pretty good.
What are your toys?
Okay, snow machines, boats, motors, all the equipment. You don't have to put that in there, but anyway, I think that's true. But it's an investment, right? And the mode of transportation has really, really changed. The equipment has been much more durable. You can go out in a, you know, when you talked about going up 70, 80 miles near the preserve, you were using four-wheelers and side-by-sides now that can handle that terrain that weren't able to just as recently as 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. You still had four-wheelers, but they weren't what they are today. Mm-hmm. All the unique things that come with suspension, with shocks, with engine durability, maintenance, all that has really changed. So outboard motors, I'm now down to using four-stroke outboard motors, and you can go twice as far as when I was a kid. The noise level in these engines are quieter. The reliability is much better. Mode of transportation has expanded opportunity that you could plan out today than before. I got GPS. I use a GPS all the time. I'm a real believer in that. I have InReach. I don't know if you know what that means. It's a device that both GPS and InReach operate off a satellite. InReach in that it's text only, but you can text anywhere you have an InReach to anybody.
Mm-hmm. So if you're in trouble somewhere, you can call for help immediately.
Believe it or not, I got stuck with a snow machine this weekend mm-hmm. out at Cape Noman. I just took out my InReach, and there's this thing called an Earth map on your cell phone, uh-huh. and it's Bluetooth connected. The InReach window is like this. You could type in whatever you want, but it'd take you a day. with Bluetooth and on your cell phone, you can type whatever message you want. With InReach, I'm able to text my daughter in Honolulu, my wife in Mesa, Arizona, anybody on my cell phone.
Right there.
And anybody else that's not on my cell phone, I could add, because you could add anybody on your cell phone, and you can text them.
So the just the way of being safe.
Oh yeah, GPS. I've been using a GPS now for over 10 years, 12 years. Mm-hmm. The first ones come out were like dumb. Mm-hmm. At least it just had Latin long. Mm-hmm. Now the GPS has come out that I just updated a little while ago, has a map, has roads, has wherever you travel with your GPS that day, you just get on there and do a backtrack, and it'll leave like a breadcrumb trail on your GPS. You could literally follow right down to within a few feet of the trail you took that day. Mm-hmm. The electronics, the communication efforts have changed that we all know about too.
How has that changed then, Roy, on how you know the land?
It made it easier.
But in memory, like if you didn't have those before, you would know your trail because of landmarks and things. So how has that changed the way you know the land?
Okay, so in traveling and going out and stuff, you learn land features. You learn when you're traveling down the road, you see a log sticking out. Mm-hmm. You don't think much of it. Right, you see a log sticking out, you go down the trail some more, you see grass, you go down the trail some more, you see an abandoned cabin, you go down the trail some more, you go up a hill, down the hill, and you see a little valley. Where all that comes in without a GPS, when you're traveling in a storm, your mind, from seeing those nuances on the trail, gives you a perspective where you're at. You learn, at least what I learned before GPS. Mm-hmm. You learn mm-hmm. without thinking about it, what you're trying to remember as you're coming back through a storm or something is what to look for next. You know, what are you, first of all, is it safe to move? And then two, you know, are you doing the right thing in your mind? And as you see different things that you remember passing, then you know where you're at in relation to mm-hmm. distance from Nome, distance from a cabin, distance from anything. So those things still are with me. Like for example, hunting. When you're out hunting for animals in the fall time, if I got a muskox permit in the back of my pocket and I'm hunting moose, but you can't shoot a muskox, but I got a permit for one. When you see them in the fall time, believe it or not, at the most, they'll be a mile or two away from where you saw them in the fall time. Hmm. At the most. You know, they're germane to that area. They're safe for them, you know, food, whatever they're doing, but they don't move very far. Mm-hmm. At least the herd itself mm-hmm. pretty much stays in that area. So as far as using things without a GPS, that's how I traveled. It's not, you know, nothing special or anything. I think you just try to remember where you're at, how things are going, features to look for.
Do you think the next generation using more is going to rely more on GPS than your way of knowing?
I don't, probably the answer is yes. The other thing is I've invested in that. I made a real personal effort to use it. And I know a lot of guys don't use it yet. Mm. So it's been my personal preference.
To use the GPS?
To use the GPS.
Yeah.
There was several times last year coming back from Serpentine Hot Springs where it was total whiteout. Mm. You couldn't see maybe 5 feet past the front of your snow machine. It was just foggy. It wasn't storming or anything. It was just fog. Thick, soupy fog. I just looked at my GPS and I just made sure my wife was behind me. I could see the snow machine headlight behind me. And just travel at 10 miles an hour, 15 miles an hour. And just follow the line on my GPS. Mm-hmm. And you'll get to a point where it kind of clears up little things, you know, a little bit. Mm-hmm. Then you're back to back to reprogramming your mind where you're at, how far you're from cabin, how far you need to go, you know, names in your mind for different places.
So a combination of the traditional way of knowing plus the technological has actually improved your mobility.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yep. Wow. And image has tracking.
Mm-hmm.
I can do tracking. Tracking mean that you share that with anybody, and anybody could see where you're at.
Wow.
Every 10 minutes. You can make the signal shorter, but I just left it with the 10-minute interval.
So if you were in an accident or your snowmobile broke down, someone could find you just like that.
And it also has SOS on it.
Okay.
Also has the EPIRB. What do they call that? Emergency something.
Mm-hmm. Personal locator.
Yeah.
Beacon. Or
It has the SOS feature on it.
Right.
So if you press that, it'll hit the wherever the EPIRB SOS signal is for airlines. It's the same one.
Wow.
I think it's the same one.
Wow.
And it'll do an SOS alarm, and it'll give that location of where that thing was set off at.
So there's no such thing as being out and alone anymore.
You hope not. But, you know, you listen to news yesterday.
Yes.
And there's four kids missing in Numaikwa.
Yeah.
I hope they find
them. I heard on the radio this morning they did find them.
They're all okay. Oh, great. Because I heard a two-year-old was among them.
Yeah. And, I mean, they were only going, 500 feet somewhere on the snow machine, but this, you know, blizzard hit, and they're lost.
Yep.
So, you know.
Yeah, it's not that 500, you don't need a GPS to go 500 feet, but that's just the way it is.
That's right.
And I'm glad for the good news.
Yes, I am too.
So,
anything else then, Roy, that you think of that you want to share that we haven't touched on? It's been wonderful. You want to just go through that?
Yeah, if you could
just
turn
to
it
see
off.
If we, yep, I can pause it just for a second. Okay, we're back with Roy, and we're going to talk a little bit about permafrost, observations of permafrost.
So when I was growing up, I mentioned earlier how we used to preserve food because we didn't have freezers and or electricity. We used permafrost to preserve our food. It has rarely changed. That is definitely a climate effect. Permafrost is less. The ground is not as frozen as long in the wintertime. It's not, in my opinion, not as intense either. So the ground underneath in many areas on Seward Peninsula is changing.
Mm.
The permafrost isn't there in certain areas. Maybe it's in there for other areas that have maybe a harsher... Can the permafrost stay there because the access from the warm weather isn't affecting that area. But there are certain pockets within our region that I've observed where permafrost is totally being affected, especially in long riverbanks that have high riverbanks, and there's mud underneath. And as the winter, spring runoff and the ice goes down the river, it gouges the rivers because it's hitting the side of the, it's forcing its side. Forcing the ice against the riverbank that's exposed to the outflow of the river, those have changed.
And so then, so the ice is coming down and it's hitting the riverbank, which isn't as frozen as it used to be. And so it's actually slumping or making or pushing it off.
Mm-hmm. Pushing it off, and then also during the summer when that area is exposed, whatever permafrost is there is melting.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is... there seems to be like their rivers are have bigger sandbars.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So there's more sediment coming into
the
rivers.
More sediment. That has changed. So permafrost has been affected by climate change in that it's melting and it's exposing certain areas more readily than others because of the warm weather.
Are you noticing where there are trees? We call them drunken trees. The trees are all starting to cut because the ground is thawing, that the trees are kind of going like that. Have you noticed that in this area at all?
Not so much.
Okay.
Fact, if anything, the trees are growing stronger because of the warmer weather. There might be areas where maybe there was a lot of permafrost in there and that's happening, but I'm looking at Pilgrim Hot Springs. I'm looking at the river drainage there. I'm looking at White Mountain, where I grew up. No. If anything, it's expanding.
Right.
And the trees, in my mind, in my opinion, whether it's cottonwood, alderwood, or spruce trees, because the winters aren't so severe, they're able to withstand and be sturdier and grow longer and bigger and thicker because of the warmer weather.
Interesting.
That's just my personal observation. Maybe other people have different opinions, but I spend a lot of time out in the country, so I think could qualify that.
Do people still use the ground for keeping things cool, or
is good it... question. The answer is no.
No.
Because the problem there is that you have to go back and undig what you put in there, and then you just, with a freezer, you just open the door and so electricity's there, you know, you're paying for the bill and stuff. So lifestyle for that has really changed that way. Access, convenience, those kinds of things, you know, have made freezers much more practical. They're easier to maintain, clean, put food in, you know where things are. And they're right next to your house. They're literally in your house, so you just got to go open the door up and get out what you need. So that's, I don't know anyone, at least in our village, that maintains any permafrost pits for over 40, 50 years. Yeah, it's been a long time since anybody's done that.
Yeah.
And the problem is maintenance. You have to put ice down in there. You know, the permafrost is there, but you put ice to keep it frozen better. But no, the conveniences outweigh using one of those.
So you were saying that you have ATVs. So when have you noticed that when you're riding on them, the permafrost is thawing or it's not as thick? How is that going for mobility?
You still are careful. I guess the easy ones are where the permafrost has melted and you could avoid it. That's the easy one. The hard one is where what's underneath it. Is there permafrost melting to when you go through or over it? Will it endanger you? That's the hard one. And those aren't too prolific or too abundant. I'm sure they're out there. It's not. The way you travel, if you're on roads too, if you're already traveling on a road, then you know. I guess that question comes in if you have to go off the road and then you're going in a different area that you're not used to being in. You just be more careful. I think you're just more careful just trying to traverse, regardless if there's permafrost or not, because the willow growth and the trail growth kind of, and the direction you're going in is dependent on the terrain. And experience in learning how to, move through that. I think that's more of a concern than just whether permafrost is there or not.
So. Interesting. Anything else, Roy, that you saw on there that might jog your memory at all of anything?
Pollution. I obviously, things have changed. There's more pollution in the air. And that's just a human thing, I think.
How can you tell there's more pollution in
the air? Maybe smell, maybe not so much immediate effects, but you can see, like when you're coming to Nome, like a big old dust cloud. It's summertime. You can see in the villages, you know, like White Mountain in the wintertime because it has hardly any wind. You could see the engines, you know, the smoke hanging out in the from the generator. Pollution in general, I think it's just a man-made thing, trash, plastics, everything. You know, we all use these things, but we sure discard them poorly. But pollution in that way, I don't know so much about air yet. I know it's there, but,
You haven't seen any problems in the waters, like this fish?
Not really. Not really? No. No. I can't think of hardly anything else.
I think you've covered a lot. I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to do this. Now I've gotten gold or grayer. So.
Well, I'm going to say thank you so much, Roy, for all your time and sharing your knowledge with us. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well,